This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
Oh, beautiful. Far heroes proved.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With its amber waves of grain and purple mountains' majesty, America the Beautiful presents a utopic vision of the nation, a wide, varied terrain of rustic beauty and good, crowned with brotherhood. In reality, America's open spaces are not free to all. In fact, visitors to America's national parks are overwhelmingly white. That's according to a 2011 report from the National Park Service, which found only 7% of annual park visitors to be African American. So what accounts for this discrepancy? In her book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Carolyn Finney delves into environmental, historical, and cultural studies to find out why the story of the American outdoors seems so white. Carolyn Finney is assistant professor of environmental science, policy, and management at the UC Berkeley. She was also chair of the Relevancy Committee for the National Parks Advisory Board. And Carolyn Finney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me here. I'm happy to be here.
Well, that 7% number really hit me. What does it reveal, however? Simply that African Americans are not visiting national parks, or do they have a different relationship to the parks and nature in general?
I think it tells us something more about, you know, who we are as a country, that it's important to understand that the national parks don't exist separate from all the issues we have had both historically and in the present having to do with race and difference, the struggles that we continue to have, you know, to talk and relate across that difference. The parks aren't separate from that. So in many ways, it's like I'm always surprised when people are surprised by that statistic. But if I were talking about something like the criminal justice system and bringing up race and ethnicity and difference, people wouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
The parks are no different. We have a complicated legacy in this country, even in terms of how the parks were founded in this country. We have to understand that when the parks were founded in this country, there were people living in a lot of those places. There were Native people living in a lot of those places that had to be removed. I have to be really careful, right? I'm not trying to paint one group of people as being bad and another group of people as being good. I actually don't find that to be a useful conversation. What I'm trying to point to is the complexity. So when someone tells me that statistic, like you said, 7%, the first thing that it points to is the complexity of our history, the legacy of that history, and what that looks like today.
Well, let's look a little bit at that legacy. How far back do we need to go to understand the African-American relationship to the environment?
So what I would say is, and those who've heard me say this before, you know, I went to, a couple of years ago in Detroit, I went to the Charles Wright Museum. And at the present, the Charles Wright Museum has the largest permanent exhibit of African-American history in the United States. And that'll change because the Smithsonian African-American Museum is being built as we speak. And I tell people, when you come into that, when you look at the trajectory of African-American history as represented by the museum, you kind of start off where you're at the gate of no return in West Africa,
mm-hmm.
you know, imagining yourself as an enslaved African. You're suddenly walking into the hull of a boat, and the way the museum has it set up, it's two stories. So the first story is supposed to be the deck of a boat where you see images of white slave owners with the whips in their hand. And if you go below deck, you see representations of black bodies like sardines lying on shelves next next to each other. And then once you walk through the hull of the boat and you're on the east coast of the United States, and the first image that you see of an African-American on American soil, there is it's an auction block, and then you see an image of an African-American toiling the land, working somebody else's land. So that's how far back you have to go if we really believe in the roots of our past. And yes, in some ways, it's very African-American, but it's all of our history in this country.
And at the same time, you know, there was this sense of expansion, you know, in American history.
Yes.
The move out west, you know, there was,
yes.
That's where the promise was. The Homestead yes. Act, you know, you can
yes.
have land if you just work it. So,
well, who the you is what's in question.
Right.
Who could have land?
A European or you're an American of European descent, not
yeah.
an African-American, certainly not a Native American, certainly.
Right.
But I'd like to just move forward to your own relationship with the land, your family's relationship with the land as you were growing up, where your father was a steward working the land for somebody else.
Yeah, and I want to say that both my parents were. So my parents were originally from Virginia. They grew up poor, high school education in a small town called Floyd. My father went off to the Korean War. And when he came back from the war, like a lot of black folks, you know, at that time, in the 40s and 50s, who were living in the South, he said to my mother, they got married and said, let's move north. We'll have a better opportunity as black people in terms of getting a job. And so he came up to New York. And he basically had two job options. He could be a janitor in Syracuse, New York, and Syracuse is about 5 hours north of New York City, or about 30 minutes outside of the city, there was a 12-acre estate owned by a very wealthy Jewish family called the Tishmans. And for anybody who's ever been to New York City, there's the Tishman Building. They own a lot
right.
of real estate in New
yeah.
York City. And they needed caretakers for that estate. They needed a couple to live on that estate full-time, 12 acres, swimming pool, lake. So my parents took that job. This was in Westchester County. And so we lived in the gardener's cottage on that property. During the week, it was like our own private park playing. We played outside all the time. You know, we could play outside. This was like in the 60s and 70s, right? But we were also in a very wealthy white neighborhood. So I tell people that Schaefer, who of Schaefer Beer, lived next door to us. Wingfield Golf Club was about a 3-minute walk around the corner. So this is a very wealthy white neighborhood. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood. I still remember some of the stories, me and my brothers. I mean, I loved the idea of playing outside. But I also tell people, I remember when I was 9 years old, walking home from school one day, and you always had police patrolling the neighborhood because there was so much wealth in the neighborhood. And, you know, I was really unimpressive. You know, I had a little afro, my little reading glasses, my little school bag. And I got stopped by a cop right around the corner from my house. And he said, where are you going? And I gave him the address. And he said, oh, do you work there? And I was 9. And I'm thinking, dude, I live there. But, you know, I'm not saying that out loud. So I just said, no, I live there. And I remember being really confused by the fact that he thought I worked there. And going home and telling my parents, and my dad then called the police station and really gave him a hard time about that. And then they never stopped me or my brothers again. That's the kind of stuff that's embedded. And this is the conversations we have in a lot of different circles today around race and difference that come up all the time.
We're talking with Carolyn Finney, who's the author of a book called Black Faces, White Spaces. It's about challenging the ideas that we have about the relationships between African Americans and the great outdoors, be it camping, be it adventuring, be it environmentalism. Carolyn, I'd like to address some of the stereotypes about black people in the outdoors here. We have a clip here from the black media web series Black Folk Don't. Now, this is from the Black Folk Don't Camp episode.
Camping? I just don't see it.
You can't really generalize to say all black folk. Most of them, though, don't camp. Because out in the woods with the bugs and all that stuff. For some reason, we don't like animals. We don't like wild things. We don't like things that we can't control.
We don't like campsites. We don't like tents.
I wouldn't, for the most part, do it unless I guess I had like some protection on me.
I was in the Boy Scouts and I didn't want to go camping. Camping is not in our blood.
Carolyn, you had an experience
yes.
of living outside. I mean, to what extent are these stereotypes actually perpetuated, but within the African-American community?
So I think that's a great question, because I am a person who believes that we all have agency. And what I mean by that is we all have choice. But as someone, as an African-American, as a human being, as a person, I like to feel like I do have some choice in my life. And I first of all, I don't speak for all African-Americans, and I need to say that, too.
Mm-hmm.
I also understand that, you know, collectively, we have worked over time to define who we are for ourselves. There was a period of time in the 60s, in particular, when it was about Black is Beautiful, Black Power, and it, you know, it was a beautiful time. And two Black psychiatrists wrote a book called Black Rage, and they talk about, it's great, we, our ledge grew, you know, in terms of who we could be as Black people. But they also asked the question, have we also shrunk our ledge? So if you love French cinema, or let's change it up, if you love to camp, are you Black enough?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a Black thing to do? But in listening to those comments, yeah, you know, there's some truth to the fact that some Black people don't like to camp. You know what? Some white people don't like to camp as well.
Right.
But it doesn't change the fact that we all have a relationship with the environment and the outdoors. If you are breathing, you have a relationship. I don't care if you live in the country, in the suburbs, or in the city. You know, we stand on land, we breathe air, we eat food, we engage with it either consciously or unconsciously every day. One of the things that was really powerful to me is when I was interviewing Black people, that many of them, I would ask them things like, how do you define environment? Or if I say parks, what comes to mind for you? Or I would say, tell me your story about the environment. Some of them would say, I don't have a story. And I would, of course, go, everyone's got a story. And at the end, a few of them would say to me, no one's ever asked me that before.
Hmm.
And for me, that's where the power was, that no one's ever asked them about their own story.
Well, historically, have visits to national parks been a white thing because African Americans may have been even barred from entering a park?
You know, at the core of the national parks, you know, and I think there was some really good intention and ideas and bigger dreams about what this country means and how we want to represent ourselves. And we do have these extraordinary places like the Grand Canyon. I think there was something really pure and good. But it doesn't exist separately from all the realities of all the violence that took place around a lot of those lands and on those a lot of those lands, to understand the violence that continues to take place around a lot of those lands, to understand that you have groups of people from various walks of life that are still fighting over their right to engage those spaces in the way that they believe is appropriate. So the parks don't exist separately. The parks, just because there's another story that I like to tell about during the civil rights, because you had all these beautiful parks, but segregation was also happening.
Right.
Right? That didn't change just because it was a national park, you know, even though at the core, the national parks are trying to do something really good, I believe. One of the stories I think I write about in the book is that there was a white professor out of Boston, sort of early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, who wanted to go visit Fundy Bay National Park, which is just over the border in Canada. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to take an African-American couple with him. And he knew that this was, you know, during the time of segregation, Canada's just right over the border. So he wrote the folks up, the superintendent, the folks up at Fundy Bay to say, you know, I just want to let you know I'm bringing this African-American couple with me. You know, I want them to be treated with respect. I want them to have a good time. When he finally got a response back from the Fundy Bay National Park, the folks there, they said, you know, we're really sorry. We can't promise you that they'll be treated well because we get a lot of American visitors here. And then we find out that the people he wanted to bring there were Dr. Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, who wanted to take a break from the civil rights movement, you know, take time to write all the things that Howard Zanizer and others who were creating the Wilderness Act at the same time the Civil Rights Act was taking place. All those ideas that I really believe they would have said, yes, absolutely, that's what you should be able to do. But they couldn't even do it across the border.
Well, but how about today? I mean, how are environmentalists and conservation groups accountable for the lack of diversity?
There's a dominant narrative, right, about how we think about and have thought about the environment and the outdoors in this country. A lot of mission statements are grounded in that dominant narrative. And what that dominant narrative doesn't do is address the complex histories for people like African Americans and other non-white peoples, where it doesn't look all nice like that. It wasn't about John Muir being able to go into a park and talk about why we need to preserve this space, because he doesn't really talk about the fact that Native people had to be removed in order for that to take place, and that John Muir also looked down upon African Americans. And I'm not trying to diminish John Muir. What I'm trying to say is the man was a human being who was flawed, mm-hmm. who lived in a country that, you know, we've that strive to take on and engage this idea of democracy, which I think is amazing, and how difficult that was, and I believe is and still is. When you talk about engaging all the different kinds of people with our different beliefs, our different ways of living, our different ways of showing up, and outdoor spaces are not immune for that. They're not separate from that. So it's not, for me, it's not about everybody showing up at every national park, right? But there is something about, you know, I believe national parks are key to telling the story of who we are. I think it's important that not only that we visit the parks, but that we can also work at the parks. It's also about employment. Who gets to have a job? Who gets to be a superintendent? Who gets to decide what narratives and stories are told? What does it mean for a young child, let's say a young non-white child, for instance, to come to a park and see somebody who looks like them and imagine, hey, maybe I could do this job. You know what I'm saying? I mean, sometimes we make really simple decisions when we're really young based on what we see and who is represented and where we think we might be welcome and how we might consider something we never considered before, like being in the outdoors. But there's multiple ways to engage the great outdoors. There's multiple ways to engage environmental issues.
Well, Carolyn Finney, fascinating talking with you. Thank you so much.
Yes. I was getting myself worked up there.
You were catching fire. Carolyn Finney, Assistant Professor of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at the University of California, Berkeley. She is author of the book Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. There's much more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
And you know, when I was in school, we used to sing it something like this. Listen here. Oh, beautiful, far spacious skies, far amber waves of grain.
Technology has been blamed for destroying everything from the publishing industry to the human attention span. But has it killed one of the world's oldest trades? Up next, what's happened to the jewelry industry in the age of the iPhone?
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Diamonds are forever, or so we thought. Turns out that global sales of diamonds and other fine jewelry have been sluggish since the 2008 recession and slid even further downward last year. Bijoli Shah blames our growing enchantment with technology. Today, parents are more likely to buy their kids a computer than earrings or choose less pricey jewelry online. Bijoli is a journalist, but she comes from a family of jewelers and wrote for Pacific Standard magazine about how technology may be killing one of the world's oldest trades, the jewelry business. Bijoli, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So a little bit about your family. How long has it been in the business?
My dad's been a jeweler since 1982, so, God, that's math that I can barely do, but over 30 years at this point.
So when did this luxury jewelry trend actually start? When did it become big here in the U.S.?
So it actually started, and I was surprised to learn this, too. This was news to me that I found out while researching, but it actually started back in the baby boomer generation, and as a sign of status, you know, these war vets would come home from the war, and they would proposed. They would get married, they would buy jewelry, and the big significant piece to signify this commitment was always this big engagement ring. And, you know, from there spawned the smaller cottage industries of earrings for an anniversary, bracelets, necklaces, before you build up to the engagement ring.
So those days seem to be over. You write in your article about how millennials are much more inclined to buy something functional. So is it the idea that we're valuing performance over these old heirlooms aesthetics?
Sure. I think that there are a lot of different factors that contribute. And I spoke to about 100 people that were both in the millennial range, but also in their early to mid-30s about this. And they all kept sort of saying variations of the same thing, which was that jewelry just wasn't as functional. And a few of them said that, you know, it signified more of a commitment than they were willing to make, even if they were willing to spend the exact same price for a different object. And it kept coming back to those two things. It was either it signified too much commitment, or it, you know, for the same price, you could get an iPad that you'd get tons of mileage out of, or a TV, or, you know, something of the like.
How about the idea of jewelry as an investment, however, as something that's going to stay around and be worth money for a long time?
So I have two different points of view on that. If you talk to my dad, who's been a jeweler forever and would love for you to believe in that, he'll be the first person to tell you that jewelry is one of the things that depreciates at a very significant rate, much closer to cars, actually, than you'd even think, even though you can keep a stone in the family and pass it down as an heirloom. And the second thing for millennials, as from people I've talked to, that's not even a thing that really comes up in conversation. I don't know if the jewelry industry is doing bad branding. Actually, I can tell you they definitely are doing bad branding. They haven't innovated the way that they've, you know, marketed to people. So not a single one of my friends would tell you that, hey, jewelry is an investment. This diamond will stay in my family for generations, even though that is, of course, very true.
So, sure. But if you think about, you know, a Chanel bag or a Patek watch or a, you know, a honking big diamond is a social statement. It's something that says to the world, I've made it. It's not as if carrying around an iPad says the same thing.
No, absolutely. And I think that there are a couple of things that play in there. Sure, if you have tons of money and can afford the statement, then I don't think your jewelry buying has dropped significantly. But I think for millennials, even affluent millennials who are making, say, about $100,000 a year, there isn't the same amount of money to spend on both the social statement and something functional. So people tend to, it's not an exact one-to-one displacement, but people are definitely choosing to spend their dollars, I suppose I should say, on these products that are more functional, you know, by and large, in these groups of millennials or in people that just don't have the purchasing power to buy, you know, both things in the same calendar year.
There are other things besides the idea of getting things that are functional, however, that have influenced this. I mean, the idea of conflict diamonds and avoiding buying conflict diamonds and gold jewelry. Now that we know how earth intensive gold mining is, do you think people have turned away for other reasons?
Yeah, of course, there are social causes. You know, we all saw Blood Diamond. It's something that we talk about and we think about. But I think that there are two bigger issues since it isn't exactly a one-to-one displacement of dollars. One is the barrier to entry for the jewelry industry. It's a little complicated. You're talking about carats and cut and color and clarity. And, you know, you have other industries that are usually a little hard to understand, eyeglass buying, for example. But you have companies like Warby Parker that came in and simplified the entire process in ways that people really have it in jewelry. And the second thing is that there are just so many more things to buy. You know, like the jewelry industry really started burgeoning in the 50s and carried onwards. You know, baby boomers came home and they were buying rings. But nowadays, there are lots of great things to spend $500 to $600 on. Back in the 70s, 80s, even the early 90s, it's not that there weren't tons of things to buy, but at that price point, there were far fewer, you know,
luxury items. Now we have so many. We have purses, we have watches, we have, you know, cashmere sweaters, whatever.
Yes, exactly. The definition of luxury has just expanded, I think, in droves in the last 10 years.
Well, you talked about Warby Parker. Now, this is the eyeglass service. Well, they'll send you four different styles at home. You can try on all of them, send them back. Obviously, you know, no one's going to send you four expensive diamonds through the mail. But what is the difference in buying something online or from a jewelry store?
I think that when you go online and from a jewelry store, the best thing, especially about jewelry, is that it's so customizable. So I love Warby Parker. I use them all the time, even though my eyesight's pretty good. But for the most part, the only thing that's customizable is my individual prescription. But for a jewelry store, I think that you go into a store and you get to talk to a jeweler and you get to say, you know, this is my budget. What's the best ring I can make? And a good independent jeweler can advise you on, you know, you can sacrifice a little here in color, but I wouldn't, you know, lose that same value on cut. You know, you can lose a little on carat, but clarity is important. So on and so forth. And I think that that's a really hard thing to move online. It's also just such an expensive piece that you're investing in that I know all about how Apple products work. And I have 100 friends I can ask and a million product reviews. And the product is always going to be the same out of the box. But no two diamonds are ever the same, even if they're both certified at the exact same cut, color, clarity, carat, et cetera. They're just, you know, you need to see it and feel it and hold it. And I don't think that we live in a see it, feel it, hold it, go to a brick and mortar type of society anymore.
Right. It doesn't sound like good news for mom and pop jewelry stores out there.
No.
But I'm thinking about the global markets. I mean, India, China, you know, places with a growing middle, upper middle class luxury market and a strong tradition in India, especially of jewelry.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
those markets are also being squeezed. Buying is down in the gold, silver, and diamond categories. And, they're, you know, you have De Beers now saying in their industry reports, which are usually pretty raw documents since they publish them online, that the entire industry buying is down. Because even in those global markets, China, India, the status sign kind of is for people that can now afford it, hey, look, I can buy an iPhone. You know, like I was just in India last year, and you wouldn't believe how many people that was their status symbol. So yes, jewelry is an important tradition, but it's sort of just that at this point. It's a tradition, and I don't see people choosing to expand on the tradition unless they really have the disposable income to do both, you know, buy jewelry and keep up with the changing trends. You know, keeping up with the Joneses is just so much harder now.
Well, it is award season anyway, Bijoli. Is your family at all rejoicing that all of those diamonds come out, those borrowed diamonds come out on display on the necks and ears of starlets?
It's really not even something that we talk about that often. I mean, we look at them amongst ourselves and we talk about people's, you know, different jewelry choices. But I think that award season just makes it a little bit harder for independent jewelers to do well because it just doesn't trickle down. You know, you see Natalie Portman wearing $1 million earrings that for all intents and purposes look like, you know, any old stud earrings you could get at the store, obviously much bigger. And you don't see a normal person going, well, I'm going to go buy some stud earrings. Too now, it continues to be a foreign, out of reach concept.
I've also noticed, you know, among J. Crew, Club Monaco, you know, the retail stores are making pretty good looking fakes.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And that's really one of the biggest issues, I think, is that the industry is getting squeezed by really good costume jewelry. Your finger's not turning green anymore. For $150, you can get a statement piece that maybe won't stay trendy, but at least you didn't buy a $1,000 statement piece that isn't going to stay trendy. And, you know, and it's all about perceived value. So if I wear a statement jewelry piece that, you know, I normally wouldn't invest in gold jewelry because it's not my style. If I wear a statement $100 gold chunky necklace, people still think it looks really good. Even the fakes that are meant to look like diamonds look pretty good now. So, you know, why wouldn't you mix and match at an affordable rate? I don't think many people come up to you inquiring about carat size, at least not at the parties I go to.
Okay, Bijoli, maybe you should start encouraging your family to get into the, you know, diamond-encrusted iPhone cases.
That is definitely the industry that we should be in. Diamond-encrusted wearables, diamond-encrusted anything that you can upgrade with diamonds every 2 years.
And as soon as you produce them, the size will change.
I'm sure. This industry has been set up for me to not get an inheritance from my parents down the road, but I'm slowly making peace with it.
Bijoli, thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. It was so nice speaking to you.
Journalist Bijoli Shah wrote the article, Has Technology Killed the Jewelry Industry? For Pacific Standard Magazine. You'll find a link to read it. It's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Shine bright like a diamond. Shine bright like a diamond.
Well, you know what they say. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. We may well question that trope given what we know about the origins of diamonds and what we just heard about the growing acceptance of convincing fakes. Still, the allure of and fascination with the world's most famous diamond continues. Rebecca Shear brings us the story of the reputedly cursed, though admittedly priceless, Hope Diamond.
This is a 1947 headline. Young McLean heirs to decide fate of tragic Hope Diamond. That was the Washington Post. Unlucky McLean Hope Diamond left in trust to grandchildren. I mean, everybody had the curse stories.
And if you check out newspaper clippings from the 1940s.
We jump around here a little bit.
As historian Paul Dixon is doing.
So then what else is in here? I don't know.
You'll know exactly what curse stories he's talking about.
Diamond jinx blamed for death of heiress. Even McLean Reynolds' death linked with Diamond. And the lead to that piece, the death of Mrs. Evelyn Walsh McLean Reynolds, 33-year-old socialite, today added another link to the chain that binds the family's fabulous Hope Diamond to tragedy.
So, okay, let's back up a bit. The Hope Diamond, for those not familiar with the world's most famous diamond, is, well, the world's most famous diamond. It's about an inch in diameter. It's a rare color, a deep, brilliant blue. And
the Hope Diamond came here in November of 1958.
It lives right here in D.C.
It's been here ever since.
And where are we right now?
The Harry Winston Gallery, the introductory gallery to our Gems and Minerals Hall at the Smithsonian Institution's Museum of Natural History.
Where Jeffrey Post spends quite a bit of time.
He's been with the Smithsonian since 1984.
I'm the curator of the National Gem and Mineral Collection.
So we can tell you a ton about the Hope Diamond, like how it came from India in the 1600s and was sold to a French merchant
by the name of Tavernier,
who then sold it to Louis XIV.
And then it became part of the French crown jewels,
which were stolen during the French Revolution.
But 20 years later, in London, a blue diamond appeared for sale.
The same blue diamond, which many believe was then purchased by King George IV.
And then after his death, was acquired by a private collector,
a certain Henry Philip Hope.
And of course, it's the Hope family name that stays with the diamond today.
And yet it can be argued that Hope isn't the diamond's most famous private owner. The gem eventually wound up in the hands of Pierre Cartier,
the famous jeweler in Paris, France,
who sold it to one of his best clients,
Evelyn Walsh McLean from Washington, D.C.,
whose name at the time was pretty much a household word.
She was in the papers every day. She was very attractive.
And, says Paul Dixon, she and her husband, Ned McLean,
who was the heir to the family that owned the Washington Post,
threw the most flamboyant parties at their mansion at 2020 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest,
which is now the Indonesian embassy. And then they also had another place, which is now known as the McLean Gardens.
They bought the Hope Diamond from Cartier. And this, dear listeners, this is when those curse stories begin.
The following year, in March, her son is playing outside the mansion.
This is her much-adored firstborn son, Vincent.
And a car bumps into him.
So the woman driving the car knocks on the front door
and said, "I just bumped into my car." She was going at a very slow speed.
As the story goes, Vincent goes to the doctor. He gets x-rays. Everything seems just fine.
And he spends the rest of the day playing out in the yard, comes in at 6 o'clock and drops dead.
And Dixon says the public goes crazy.
This is within months of having fully acquired the Hope Diamond. And, you know, now the story is that Tavernier, the original French merchant, had plucked it from the forehead of a Hindu idol. And after he sold it to the French royalty, he was devoured by a pack of dogs. And it's also cited as the proximate cause of Marie Antoinette's death, etc.
That etc. also includes the death of another relative of Evelyn Walsh McLean, Evelyn Walsh McLean Reynolds, that 33-year-old socialite from the headlines.
Hope Diamond heiress is found dead in Capitol. This is the announcement that her granddaughter, beloved granddaughter, has died of an overdose of sleeping pills.
Throw in the fact that Ned McLean winds up dying in an insane asylum.
He had convinced himself that he was an assassin hired to kill Ned McLean.
And of course the public is going to go nuts. But, says curator Jeffrey Post,
no real evidence would back up a curse.
Not so fast.
For example, you know, it didn't come from an idol's eye. And, in fact, Tavernier lived to a ripe old age.
As did many of the diamond's owners, actually.
In fact, one of my colleagues, Richard Curran, here, has done a careful analysis of all the people who have come in contact with the Hope Diamond. And, in fact, their lifespan is, on an average, greater than what you'd expect, you know, for the average population.
What's more, many of them enjoyed great prosperity.
You look back and there was a long reign during which the French royalty did pretty well in France. They acquired the diamond in 1668, and it wasn't until 1792 that there was a revolution. Likewise, you know, you look through the people who owned it in the 1800s, and many of them did pretty well.
It's all a matter, he says, of perspective. If you want to create a fabulous story about an object bringing bad luck,
well, you'll focus on all the bad things that happened to anybody who happened to be associated with that object.
And if you want to write a good luck tale,
then you just focus on all the good things that happened to those people over that period of time.
And in the case of the Hope Diamond, Post says the Smithsonian actually has experienced a lot of good since Harry Winston, who bought McLean's jewelry after her death, donated the stone.
These world-famous, spectacular gems that we have here on display with the Hope Diamond, almost all of these came here to the museum after the Hope Diamond came here. It was the gift from Harry Winston that really intrigued people to want to continue this idea of building a great national gem collection.
And it's a collection that millions of people come and visit each year. But while they enjoy all of those spectacular gems, the Hope Diamond, well, it's pretty much the star.
How much would it be worth today?
Priceless. I mean, if there ever is anything that you just can't put a price on, I would say it's the Hope Diamond.
And, says Paul Dixon, how could it not be? In addition to being such a rare stone, it's managed to make its way from India to France to Britain, back to France, and, of course, finally here.
And the rest is history.
Or at least, well, a darn good yarn. I'm Rebecca Shear.
So, beauty comes at a price, a lesson that anyone who strives for smooth, hairless skin will tell you. Up next, we're going to take a look at our historical fascination with hair removal and what it reveals about shifting views of racial and social status in the U.S. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short...
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The American fixation with body hair began with its first colonial settlers. Thomas Jefferson, Lewis and Clark, and other 18th century thinkers wrote at length about the seemingly hairless natives. Their smooth faces and bodies were thought to signal unmanly fragility, self-mutilation, and savagery. A similar reasoning applied to the supposed inferiority of African slaves. Some 250 years later, Americans spend billions of dollars and untold hours removing body hair as a means of beautification and empowerment. While at Guantanamo Bay, the forced shaving of detainees is considered to be a form of humiliation and even torture. Clearly, the familiar act of hair removal has meaning. Yet when Bates professor Rebecca Herzig began pursuing it as a topic of study, some of her peers deemed it too mundane, even repellent. But she pressed on and joins us now to talk about her new book, Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. Rebecca Herzig, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. It's just such a pleasure to be here.
Well, there's so many facets to this issue that I never even considered. What led you to hair removal?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. There are probably a lot of complicated personal reasons, but professionally, I think it really started when I was a graduate student in the history of technology. And it just seemed that the stories that were being told about technology focused almost exclusively on giant, spectacular things that few people really ever came in contact with, like nuclear weapons, say. And nuclear weapons are undeniably important, but in the history of humanity, obviously very, very few people have had any kind of contact with them. And I just got interested in a more general way about the sorts of artifacts and systems that we run into in our much more daily life and how they might shape us even more than the more spectacular things that we tend to focus on.
Well, certainly shaping policy for Native Americans, these arguments over the Indian character based on their hair eventually underscored policies that subjugated Native Americans. Tell us about some of those underlying beliefs.
The policy changed over time, but undergirding all of it, of course, was questions or really assumptions about the fundamental character of Native people. And the struggle that white settlers were having were Native peoples more or less naturally like European settlers, or were they naturally so dissimilar that they could never be acculturated or educated into European ways of life? The Native people, of course, had their own perspectives on all these issues. But just thinking from the European point of view, there was actually quite a lot of debate about whether indigenous people could ever become, quote, civilized, or whether they would always be fundamentally different. And in that sense, all these observations about body hair played a very central role in that it was one of the defining elements of racial difference, according to the European observers. So there were just treatises after treatises written about whether natives had more or less hair than Europeans naturally by birth, or whether they were somehow removing it in ways that the Europeans might not be able to see. And there were all these kind of ethnologists who went out trying to observe Native people and their practices so that they could report on what their bodies were really like. And what I suggest in the book is that those claims about Native bodies then informed policy.
Well, and this is significant of a kind of pathologizing hair growth that we see throughout American history. In your book, reading about the dawn of the 20th century, this idea that hair growth, excessive hair growth especially, is a sign of sexual or mental or criminal deviance, and even distinction between hair types becomes a kind of form of judgment. I think is there a case where you write about specimens of hair proving the guilt or innocence of a man on trial for lunacy? Am I remembering
yes.
that correctly?
Yes, yes, yes. Whether the hair marked him as genuinely insane or not. And they studied his little hair filaments under the microscope to see whether he was genuinely insane.
Well, what was going on in American society and thinking that led to that? One of the things you point to, of course, is Darwin and Darwin's Descent of Man. What role did his discourse on denudation of man play in this theory and judgment of hair?
I was actually surprised by what a prominent role Darwin did play. I went into this thinking, You know, historians, we tend to give Darwin too much credit for almost, you know, all kinds of major cultural shifts. But as I went through the records, I found, you know, it's actually in this case not overstated that there were very clear differences in the way that body hair was narrated before Darwin's ideas kind of took hold in the U.S. and after Darwin's ideas. And really specifically in Descent of Man, he took up the question of physical differences between human beings very explicitly. And hair was a giant part of that discussion for Darwin. And in the wake of that book and its hold on culture, without question, attitudes towards body hair in the U.S. started shifting. Whereas before The Descent of Man, to have no body hair in the way that European observers thought Native American bodies were was a sign of sort of peculiarity or the word that the European observers used, deficiency. But after Darwin, having too much visible hair was considered a sign of depravity or deviance in some way. And in all the ways you mentioned, racial, mental, sexual, political, all these various kinds of ideas about a difference. But Darwin has to be understood in the wider context of the professionalization of science and medicine more generally. And I think that's where some of the power over actual public opinion and public practices starts to change as people go see physicians and people read professional scientists in the public press, popular press, and so on. I think that's how the idea that experts might have something special to say about hair growth starts to take hold.
Well, we're discussing a topic not normally discussed in polite society, and that is body hair, specifically removal thereof, which our guest Rebecca Herzig found has a lot to do with race and science and industry and class in America. She covers it all in her new book called Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. So at the time that where women are fighting for access to the vote, protesting or fighting for equal education, they were seen as aggressive and manly. There's an ad that you quote from the DeMiracle Chemical Company. America may become a nation of bearded women if consumers don't act fast. What was going on here?
Yes. Well, certainly long before women actually acquired the right to vote in the U.S., there had been kind of bubbling up movements for women's emancipation. And all of that was really kind of coming to the fore in the late 19th, early 20th century, which kind of made this culminating moment in the right to vote. But in those years leading up to it, there was just a much more general cultural conversation about women's roles and conflict over women's roles. And hair was right in the middle of all those conversations. Are women, as you suggested, are they becoming too masculine? Are they becoming too aggressive? And visible hair became a kind of emblem. It didn't really become the emblem of feminism itself until into the 1970s. And a big part of this was the very first issue of Ms. Magazine. Some of your listeners might be familiar with a very famous cover with Wonder Woman holding a speculum on that front cover. But one of the articles named on that cover issue was an essay about body hair and whether removing body hair was actually a new frontier of the feminist struggle and women should stop this kind of tyrannical oppression of their bodies and put down their razors and their depilatories and so on. And after that issue came out, it really did become a kind of symbol of what we now call second wave feminism. And all kinds of people started describing, especially armpit hair, but also unshaven legs as the sign of feminist consciousness. That didn't last so long. You know, we still associate visible hair under the armpits or on the legs with feminism. But the movement for women to stop shaving their hair was really pretty limited to the 1970s.
This points to one of the questions that kind of runs through the book, you know, whether hair removal is voluntary or it's an enforced social norm, you know, whether we consciously feel like there's something wrong with us if we have body hair or unconscious. I'm going to play a little clip here from the film of Sex and the City where this comes up as a topic.
What? I didn't know I was going to be wearing a bathing suit.
What are you talking about?
I forgot to wax.
Since when? 1998?
I've had other things on my mind.
I could be on death row and not have that situation.
Well, Samantha, when you're married, you have a different set of priorities.
Oh, honey, don't claim marriage. This one's married, and she's not growing a national forest. How do you even cross your legs? Let me make you a spa appointment.
So that points to, you know, a very funny sort of demonstration of, you know, what has become a social norm, the shaving or waxing of pubic hair. This is something that was pretty much unheard of in the year 2000 and is now ubiquitous. Men and women get waxed. Is this voluntary? Is this, or has this become a deeply ingrained social norm?
That's a great question. I think it's incontrovertible that it's become a social norm in a lot of ways, but that alone doesn't address the question of how much then volition or will do we as individuals have to intervene in social norms. And what I found striking is that that question has been at the forefront of American life since as far back as I could trace, certainly since the founding of the nation in the 18th century. Americans care a lot about that question. How willful am I? How voluntary are my actions? Do I have freedom? And what finally dawned on me is just how specific that cultural fascination is over whether we have free will or not. That in itself is part of American culture. And as women got more and more political and economic freedom, the question in feminist discussions of the body are, was it a voluntary choice? You know, did you get the breast implants because you really wanted to or because you felt pressured to? Did you shave your legs because you really wanted to or because you felt you had to conform to those social ideals? And even that question, how voluntary are our individual actions, is itself a cultural preoccupation along with hairlessness. And I think a perfect example of this, there's a lot of existing social science research on hair removal, and especially women's hair removal, why they do it, when they started, how did bikini waxing get so popular, those sorts of questions. But one of the things that is found across that social science research is that American women report that there are social norms governing all these things. There are social expectations. But they report that those norms shape the behavior of other women. But their own behavior, this research shows, the women report, is not shaped by those norms. So important is this idea of autonomy or free will to us that we attribute it to ourselves, even if we're willing to look out at other people and say, oh, of course, they're just doing these things because of social norms, but I'm not. I have free will over this question.
It's the American way.
Yes. Yes.
Well, Rebecca Herzig, it's a fascinating history, and I thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. This has just been a joy.
Rebecca Herzig, she's a scholar and a Bates College professor and author of several books, including most recently Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. You can find more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And now a story of hair management from the mouths of babes. When WNPR reporter Jeff Cohen's 5-year-old daughter, Sadie, noticed that her sister Eva's hair was getting a bit too long, she decided to take matters into her own hands. What resulted was one of the worst haircuts ever. Jeff sat down with the two girls to do what a reporter does best, get the facts.
Sadie said, do you want me to cut your hair? And I said, yes.
I climb up on the bathroom to get the scissors. They had scissors, and they just kept cutting. Then I started getting and it was like so hard to cut. I was like, la 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 la. I started at the bottom, la la la. Then it went That's how it made the long piece and then the short piece.
So, were you not even looking?
I was looking at them.
She was looking, and she noticed that she cut it all the way to. Some of it was short and some of it was long.
Did you mean to cut off that much hair?
No.
How much hair did you want to cut off?
Well, I was just trying to cut off the curls.
And why did you think she needed a haircut?
Because it was all the way down to her, it was almost about down to her tush. And if she grew it any longer, it would make, when she wiped her butt, her hair would like go into the toilet. It'll be gross.
I did not like when it was almost down to my butt, and it was really itching my my hips.
Now, did you think that you wanted a haircut?
No.
But you told her you wanted her to cut your hair.
Yeah, but I really wanted a hair cutter to cut it.
When did you realize that something had gone wrong?
When I was finished and I put the scissors back, I looked at her and I was like, uh-oh. This is bad, 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 bad.
Did Sadie told you to come downstairs and show us?
Yeah. And I said, you got my hair cut, Mommy. Isn't it nice? And Mama looked at it and she said, I heard yelling, Eva crying. Sadie, Eva, what were you thinking? Why were you thinking to cut your hair? I was crying and I said, Sadie cut my hair. And I told you not to.
And what did you do with the hair?
I hid it under the radiator.
Did you think we were going to like it?
No.
No?
I didn't know you were going to scream like that, though. Hair cutting it takes, like, a lot of concentration. We learned not to do it again. Ever again. That was really, really, really terrible, but everyone does that kind of stuff sometimes. It happens, like, once. Or twice. Or three times in every life. Or twice. Once.
What do you think about Eva's haircut now?
It's pretty nice. I can't imagine her hair long anymore. It's been so long since I cut it.
And that story, the most popular ever on the Public Radio Exchange, came to us from Jeff Cohen. Thanks so much for joining us today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org and on the new and improved NHPR app. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, on New Hampshire Public Radio.